Thank you, everyone. Welcome to our next installment, our post-Passover chametz. We were very chametz tonight with pizza and pasta. Ooh, good stuff. With our first post-Pesach installment of the Kollel Aharon Veleah, this mysterious group that are benefactors of ours, Yom HaShoah, darkness, then and now. We want to dedicate the class specifically for the 6 million. That's all we have to say. I would like to explore with you tonight a history from the Torah, from our Bible, of hatred. The source of where the Sinas Yisrael, the hatred of Jews comes from, and in the Bible, in the Torah, and then, of course, contextualize it into modern day. So let's begin with source one. Amalek. This very strange little Bedouin-style nation that we have spoken about a couple of times in previous classes, at Purim time especially, if you recall. Amalek, who are the ancestors of Haman, Hitler, the Nazis. Amalek makes their first appearance in the Torah, in the Bible, as a nation. At the end of a parsha called Bishalach. And Bishalach is notable because it is the famous Parsha, in fact, we just read it a second time on Passover, we loved it so much, where we recount the Kriyat Yamsuf, the splitting of the Sea of Reeds, the famous Az Yashir Moshe, where Moses sings the Song of the Sea. After that, just about 50 or so verses later, we come to Amalek. The Jewish people are in a place called Rifidim, and they say some very not nice things about where is God? Is God in our midst or not? And God sends Amalek. Amalek comes, they're a little whacked out tribe, and they come and they are essentially the world's first suicide bombers because they can't possibly destroy the Jewish people at that time. Yes, the Jewish people are in their infancy as a nation. They don't have a structured army yet as such. They were slaves just a few weeks before. However, we have the Darth Vader space shield. If any of you are Star Wars fans, you remember the Death Star had an impregnable special force field around it. And all the fighters could shoot any weapons of any technology and they would just blip. They wouldn't even penetrate the hull because they couldn't even get access to the hull of the ship until the Jedis had to go through and try to knock some of the power sources out. So we had our own version, a kosher Jewish version of, you see, you didn't know that Jedi, you know, Jedi are the rabbis. So, Yehudi, Jedi, Yehudi, it actually sounds very similar. So we have our own version. We have the Anane HaKavod, the clouds of glory that would protect us. So Amalek comes and this suicide attack. They know that they can't really injure the Jewish people. So what do? They get the people who are Nechishalim, the stragglers, those who were not protected by the clouds of glory that were sort of couldn't keep up because perhaps they were derelict in their duty as Jews or there are other reasons. But they attack sort of the Nechashalim, the ones who are the stragglers. But they make a statement. We, Amalek, are going to get you. And if it's not today, then it'll be my great-great-grandson, Amalek says, a guy named Haman. And if he doesn't succeed, then maybe, you know, go forward a couple thousand years, you get to the Nazis, which is today, Yom HaShoah. And if it's not the Nazis, there's others, as we'll speak about. So this verse tells us something very profound. Listen to the statement. Vayomer, and he, Moses, makes a declaration. Ki yad al kesko, because the hand, ostensibly the hand of Amalek, is on the kisei, the throne, the chair of the Eternal One, God. Milchama l'Hashem ba'Amalek, that there should be a war for the Lord against Amalek, midor dor, from generation to generation. And our rabbis explain, Rashi brings us down, the great Torah commentator, that why do we spell the word case without an aleph? It should be kisei, a chair, a throne. And Hashem's name is usually four letters, the ineffable name. Yud, Kei, Vav, Kei. Here it's only two letters. So why is it lacking? Because God says, I am not Shalem. I, the Lord, am not whole as long as this Amalek exists in my world. And when that time will come, he swears by his throne, does Hashem, that you, the Jewish people, need to make this generational war. So what does it mean from generation to generation? So a simple explanation would be like this. That Amalek exists here, but there's also a part of Amalek that will exist in the time of King Saul. And then another part of Amalek that exists in the time of King David. And then, so in other words, in every generation, they will rear their ugly head. That would be the simple explanation. But what would be the more profound? That this is an eternal war. That the Amalek that represents Amalek in the time of Moses and Joshua, here in the context of Exodus, is not the same Amalek that's going to appear to you in a generation or more or more or more. That in each and every generation, as we say at the Passover Seder, Bechol dor vador omdim aleinu lechaloseinu, in each and every generation they rise up against us to destroy us. But God is with us and we win. So in other words, Amalek doesn't have to be this biological genetic Amalek to still be categorized as Amalek. Amalek is sort of a catch-all phrase for a sina, a hatred, a vitriol against the Jewish people that will exist from generation to generation. But what is scary is that they will manifest themselves differently. Their identity will not be the same. It will not be, oh, well, they're always going to have a triangle hat. So everybody who's into Hamantashen hats, look out for them. No, if only it were so easy. In each and every generation, there can be a new Amalek. And therefore, one might say, well, what about Hamas, for example? They're not genetically Amalek. I would say they're probably from Yishmael. Right? They're Arabs, most of them. And yet, according to this approach, they would be Amalek. Because if it looks like a dog, it barks like a dog, and it bites like a dog, for all intents and purposes, they have always sought the destruction of not only the Jewish people of Israel, but their ultimate goal is the Jewish people everywhere. So they are Amalek, for all intents and purposes. Now, again, I know that the Prime Minister of Israel got in a lot of trouble. Some people were trying to nuance his words, because he quoted and said, oh, well, it's a genocidal war, because when King Saul fought, the only problem was, Bibi Netanyahu is not an idiot, okay? He's an MIT guy, you know, he's a very smart guy. And the quotation that he quoted was not from King Saul. There was no context to King Saul at all. It wasn't that war. You know what war it was? This war. And there was no targeting of men, women, and children. It was the army of Amalek that Joshua that day vanquished, finished. It's the war that is recounted in Kitetse when we have the mitzvah to remember. And there's no mitzvah, there's no commandment to wipe out Amalek. You don't kill men, women, and children. It can only be done with a court, a Jewish Sanhedrin, to proclaim that there's an actual war. These are the targets. It has to all be on the up and up. It's not just, oh, we go after men, women, and children the way King Saul was told. No, that wasn't the quote. It was taken out of context. Well, what else is new? So now we understand that in each and every generation, there's going to be an Amalek. But it's going to be different for every generation of Jewish people, which is a challenge, A, because they're not the same, they're not going to be the same monstrous entity in the generation of Moses and Joshua as they were later and later and later and later. They're going to be something different. They may not be readily identifiable. So that's a challenge. Let's look at source two. This is the Genesis now, and I mean it literally because it's from the book of Genesis, sorry, of where Amalek and this hatred comes from. And it is biblical in origin. So you know how the bad guys in comic books always have an origin story? The heroes and the bad guys. So this is the origin story, if you will, of Amalek. Okay? And he starts with his great-great-grandfather, Esau. Big Red, as we call him. Remember? Remember the chewing gum Big Red? So Esau had a lot of red hair. He was called Edom, which means the red guy, because he ate the red lentil soup, remember? And he got this acronym. He became known as this kinoi, this nickname, the red guy, Esau, Edom, okay? And the Edomites are the founding fathers, if you will, that nation, those people of a lot of the Western world come from Esau. So he's a pretty formidable guy, right? He's the twin brother of Jacob. Now, it says that when Esau and Jacob finally meet after 20 years apart. Now, why were they apart? Because Esau wanted to murder Jacob for having taken his blessings. And so mom, Rebekah, Rivka, said to dad, Isaac, please send Jacob away to my dear brother Laban, and he can be in exile in Laban's house, which is somewhere near Iran and Iraq, whatever, Turkey area, wherever that is, Aram Naharaim, wherever that might be. And he can have sanctuary there, and I'll send for him when it's time to come home. So dad, Isaac, tells Jacob to run away. So after 20 years, Jacob has the wives, the 11 children, the 11 tribes of Israel. Benjamin's on the way. Rachel is pregnant with Benjamin, and they're coming back home. So he sends emissaries to Esau to tell him, I'm home. I was with Laban, our dear uncle, who was the master, by the way, of all the dark properties of the world. Laban was the Emperor Palpatine of that dark side. And therefore, when he sends the message of veiled threat to his brother Esau, I'm coming home. In Lavan Garti, I was with Lavan for 20 years, and I kept every rule of the Torah, and I'm the same Jacob, the honest man of integrity, the man of piety, the Ishtam, the simple, pure soul. I was never corrupted by our uncle Lavan. That is a mind-bending statement. So Esau's kind of scared of him. But he's coming with Arba Meos Ish, with 400 men. It's a famous story. And they meet on the battle array, so to speak, because Jacob doesn't know. 400 generals, why are you coming to make war with me? Are you coming to kill me? Are you coming to make peace? What is going on? He doesn't know the intention of his brother Esau. So he prepares for the worst and hopes for the best and prays to God. Okay, so he divides up his family. And the two brothers meet on this field, and they run to each other. Esau runs, and he grabs and hugs Jacob. And listen to this verse. Source 2. And Esau ran toward him. Vayaratz Esau likrato. Vayichabkehu. And he hugged him. He embraced him. And then it says, Vayipol al tzavarav. Vayishakehu vayivku. And then Esau fell upon Jacob's neck, kissed him, and they wept. Now you notice the second last word in the Hebrew has these weird nikudos, these dots above each and every letter. And they're actually in a Sefer Torah, in a kosher Torah. If you happen to be up there watching the rabbi or whoever, the Rabbi Levitin reading the Torah, and that's your aliyah, that's your honor, those dots are in the Torah. Usually the Torah is sans any punctuation, but those dots are over each and every letter of that word, and he kissed him. Esau kissed Jacob. Why are they there? So there's a difference of opinion. Two rabbis, two opinions. Usually two rabbis, 100 opinions. So let's look at source number 3. This is from Rashi. And he kissed him. Esau kissed Jacob. There are dots over the word. There is controversy. Ooh, there's a machloket concerning this matter in a Braita of the Sifri in rabbinical literature. Some rabbis interpret the dots to mean that Esau did not kiss his brother Jacob wholeheartedly. Stop. So in other words, when you read the word, and he kissed him, normally a person says, well, that's tender. It's love. They're brothers. 20 years has changed. Maybe Esau has repented for his evil ways, and he's genuinely moved to hug his brother Jacob. Let bygones be bygones. But the rabbis say, no. That is the kiss of death. Exactly. Thank you, Carolyn. Right? It's like the Don Corleone kiss. You don't want the Don Corleone kiss. I'm making an offer you can't refuse, right? Now, so one opinion or a multiple rabbis who are not identified here say that he didn't kiss him with his whole heart. Don't think he kissed him b'lev shalem. No! He kissed him to rip his throat out like a wild animal. And he tried to bend down and get the throat, the jugular. But then Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the great author of the Zohar, this book of Kabbalah, of mysticism, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the Rashbi, says, no, it's the opposite. In other words, there's ambiguity here, but it's the opposite. Everybody knows that Esau always hates Jacob. So if it says he kissed him, it means that he actually kissed him the only time in his life with love. Because obviously, if I told you Esau's coming to kiss Jacob, you're protecting the throat. Like you're like an animal going like, no, I'm going to protect my throat from the wolf. That is a davar pashut. That's simple. So it's the opposite of that. In other words, you see the caffeine's taking effect already. The opposite is true because clearly Rabbi Shimon says, if I just gave you the information, tell me what's going on. Esau kisses his brother. You would say, well, obviously there must be enmity. No, the dots are telling you it's the opposite of enmity. It's love. And he kissed him with love. And he was moved by this outpouring of honor and respect that Jacob gave to Esau. So it's interesting because those dots are basically erasing that word and he kissed him. But here's the part of the quote that I love. And this is germane to tonight. You ready? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Ready? It is a well-known tradition that Esau hated Jacob. But his compassion was moved at the time and he kissed him wholeheartedly. But the words in Hebrew are not, it's a well-known tradition. They're much more profound. It says, listen to this. Halacha hi biyadua. It is a known, established rule that Esau hates Jacob. Finished. Now, why is that germane to our discussion tonight? Because this is the source of that hatred that we spoke about, the irrational hatred that eventually morphs into this entity known as Amalek. Now, it's not Amalek yet. It's still Esau. But you shouldn't be surprised if I told you that Amalek is the grandson of Esau. Well, how do we get to that grandson? I'm glad you asked. Look at the next source. Number four. We mentioned this in one of my previous classes. Timnah was a Pelegish, a concubine to Eliphaz, son of Esau. Eliphaz was Esau's firstborn son. And she bore to Eliphaz, there he is, Amalek. Stop. What's the significance of the fact that Timnah was a concubine? Sometimes, in those days in the Bible, in the Torah, guys had, consorts, whatever you want to call them, concubines, okay? Timnah was a concubine. No. Torah says she wasn't just a regular concubine. She's a princess concubine. What? The passage here is to proclaim the greatness of Abraham and his family. How much people long to attach themselves to his descendants. This Timnah was a daughter of chieftains. As it is said, and the sister of Lotan was Timnah. Lotan was one of the chieftains of the inhabitants of Seir. Therefore, she said to the family of Abraham, I may not be worthy of marrying you, she said to Eliphaz, Esau's son, but if only I could be your prostitute, your concubine, can I come then? Wow. So in other words, this lady Timnah, making an effort to see, this lady Timnah was so out there. She was so, how do I say this not nicely? She was so crazed, hell-bent on joining the religion of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that if she was not allowed access to the family tree from Abraham that goes through Jacob, she looked at the family tree and says, wait a minute, there's another family tree because Isaac had twins. So if I can't marry into the Jacob side because they know that I'm a lunatic and I'm dangerous, then I could always marry the Esau side. So she went to Esau's family. So you have Esau, his firstborn is Eliphaz. She goes to Eliphaz and says, hey, pal, would you like another wife? He says, no, die, ain't new. I have enough wives. Thank you. So she says, well, would you like a girlfriend? I'm offering my services. I could be your concubine. Yeah, all right. As long as I don't have to sign any contracts, we're good to go. And they have a child, Amalek. So in other words, listen to this. Esau is described as Halacha hi biyadua she'Esau son is Yaakov. It is a known established rule that Esau has contempt and hatred for Jacob. But that wasn't enough to create Haman and the Nazis. No. You needed to take the genetics of Esau through his son Eliphaz and then this insane woman Timnah. So the marriage or the union, if you will, of this whacked out lady Timnah, taking the already potentiality of hatred that lurked within the genetics of Esau's family that we already described in detail. So that merger creates this monstrous entity known as a Malek. So in other words, it was within the confines of the genetics of the DNA of Esau to hate Jacob, but he wasn't going to become Haman-like in his craziness. It took a Timnah to bring that out. So now, let's skip a few generations, shall we? Because now you have a Malek's product. Generations later, from the failed annihilation that King Saul, that we mentioned, was supposed to wipe out Amalek, and he allowed King Agag to live another day. King Agag is the ancestor of Haman, the Agagite that we meet in the book of Esther. Okay? And I'm just going to paraphrase now for the sake of time, number 6. Okay? So Haman comes out in the book of Esther. We just had this. It's great stuff. And he is at the zenith, as you would say in America. Zenith would be the old country. He was at the zenith of his powers. Picture this, okay? He was invited to a party, he and he alone, with the king and the queen, because Esther wanted him to come. Maybe she has a crush on him. At the end of the party, there's going to be a second party, right? Who's the only other person other than the king and queen, Ahasuerus and Esther? Haman. So he's thinking to himself, wow, you know, when I overthrow this idiot king, Ahasuerus, and I get rid of him, depose him, and I become the king, I kind of like the Esther. She's beautiful. I'll keep her on. She can keep her gig as the queen. So he's thinking, great, better than my wife, Zeresh. I'm sure he doesn't say it to his wife. Okay. All the money that he offered for the imprisonment, enslavement, and demolition, extermination of the Jewish people, the king turned it down. He said, no, here's the ring. It's on me. So all his money, and a lot of money, his Cayman Islands accounts, they're intact. So he's got all his money. Everybody bows before Haman. So he's got all the glory in the world. Everything's going great. It's the best. And he walks out of the palace on his way home. And Mordechai the rabbi is sitting there waiting to check on Esther. And what does Mordechai not do to Haman? No bow. No respect. No acknowledgement of him. So he's Rodney Dangerfield on steroids. No respect. He loses his mind. And he goes home. And he walks in. And he goes from the zenith of his power, of his joy, his simcha. And now he can't even think clearly. And he relates over, oh my gosh, in the kingdom. And he tells everything I just said. I'm the best. I'm the hottest guy in the world. The king, the queen, they all love me. I'm the greatest. I'm the hottest guy in the world. Money, glory, it all. But that Mordechai, the Jew, he will not acknowledge me. Nothing. He loses his mind. He literally says, listen to these words. Hakol zeh, all of this grandeur and glory, eino shovili, is worth nothing to me because Mordechai, the rabbi, lives. So if I was there, if I was a member, God forbid, of Haman's clan, I put up my hand, say, Dad, your old dad, but isn't Mordechai a Jew? Yeah. Didn't you already get the ring and you issued a letter in the name of the king? He's going to be exterminated next Adar 13 along with the rest of the Jews. Yeah. So, Dad, I'll use a vernacular from today. Chill. It's okay. Mordechai is living out a few days here and there, but he's on the Auschwitz-Birkenau. He's going there along with all the other Jews. So just, Dad, relax. Let the letter play out. Mordechai will be dead. All your enemies will be dead. So just relax. No, I want him dead. So again, vernacular, Don Corleone. I want him dead, dead, deader now. I want his head on a plate, right? I can't wait for next Purim. So then, of course, they come up with the brilliant idea, construct a gallows so tall that Ahasuerus can see it, and you get hanged on the gallows. Beautiful. Bravo, Haman, because you can't wait. So because you can't wait, right, the idiot can't wait, thank God, right, he's so diabolically possessed with the elimination of this one human being, Mordechai, he could have won the day. Well, I mean, obviously he wouldn't have won the day because we're here talking about it. But theoretically, right, he undermines everything by building the gallows, and he swings on the gallows. Wow. So his obsession is pathological. Where do you think he got it from? His dear old grandmother, Timnah, who combined the genetics with Eliphaz, and you create this monster, Amalek, and it's handed down. So in other words, in the Amalek vision of the world, It doesn't matter how much money, how much glory, the thousand-year Reich. Schuckel Gruber, are you an idiot, his generals told Hitler. That's Hitler, by the way. Why are you taking manpower and millions of dollars and all the most brilliant people to get the trains and building all these death camps all around Poland, everything? You're an idiot. You're trying to fight a two-front war. Just chill. Wait till like 1946 when the war is won, because you're going to win. You got a nuclear weapon on the way. You got the V-2 rocket. You got the first jet fighter. All the technology the Germans had, right? Just let it play out. Deal with the Jews later when you have cemented the thousand-year Reich. What was Hitler's answer to his generals? Hamann's answer to his generals. I cannot exist in a world where the Jews exist. And if it means I go down with the ship, I'm all in. Do you see that? It's an unbelievable thing. And what I just quoted you, I know I did it in a Hamann historical way, but you'll read Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, which I did one Tisha B'Av. It's right there for you to see. His own generals they lost their minds. Rommel and the rest, we're being led by a Schotte, by an idiot. Seriously, you're going to take all the manpower for the Jewish, the final solution is so important to you? Yeah. Of course, it's his whole world because he's a Malik. He's Haman. I can't exist if Mordechai the Jew exists. So sanity is not part of the equation, clearly. Okay. Let us now look at one of the most mind-bending Talmudic quotes you're ever going to see. If I didn't show you this and I didn't promise you that this was written 500, it was redacted about 500. So we're talking 1,500 years ago. Okay? Listen to the quote. Okay? And this is Jacob praying. Now remember, Jacob, does he know evil? It's his brother, Esau. So he knows evil. So he's praying to God. Listen to the prayer. Ready? Said Jacob to the Holy One, to God, Master of the Universe, do not allow Esau his heart's desire. Do not remove his bit. A bit is what you put in an animal to contain its ferocity, to keep it under control. This prayer that Jacob prayed refers to, this is mind-bending, Germania min ha-Edom, Germany from the nation of Edom. For if they were to be let loose, they would destroy the world. Talmud, Masechet Megillah, 6a, 6b. It's right there, written 1,500 years ago. Now, obviously, the Germany we're referring to in the Talmud didn't exist 1,500 years ago. We're talking about a clan of Germans. You know, there were clans in Europe. So you had Germanic tribes and people. But he's already, Jacob, he knows that if God allows Germania, who are part of whose family? Esau. So in other words, he's literally cementing our approach tonight through this short little version of the Talmud. Jacob, through his prayer, is telling us, my gosh, there's a monster that my brother has let loose. And if the elements of my brother, Germania, which is Amalek's great-great-great-grandson, if they are allowed to be let loose, not only the Jewish people, but our entire world is in the balance. Yeah. Wow. I mean, this quote, when I first saw this, not that I didn't believe it, but I was a little disbelieving. Just to see it, I sat here looking at it. I said, wait a minute, how could the Gemara say, Germania min ha-Edom? What? Like, how is this possible? Again, it's right here in black and white. You can research it yourself after the class. So where are we then? Where are we? We're at a point, as we said at the outset, we have Amalek. And in every generation we learned, Amalek is going to be a different entity. It's not going to appear to us in generation A as it does in generation B or C or D. Because Becholdor Vador Chai, you know, Omdim Alein and Lachalosein, it was in the Haggadah. In each and every generation they rise up against us, we don't know who the they could be. And every generation is different. Now, this prayer of Jacob that he davened for us, he prayed to God, is so prescient. I mean, it's mind-bending that he would be sensitive to his own brother's power. It's not a surprise, though, because remember we learned, Halacha hi b'yaduah she'esa sonas Yaakov. It's a fact, it's a factoid, as they say, a rule, that Jacob always feels that hatred, contempt from his brother Esau. It's just lurking below the surface. And if you consider who Esau is, that he's Edom, and Edom are the Romans, we're still in the Galut. We're still now in the exile that the Romans foisted upon the Jewish people when they destroyed our second temple in the year 70. Where do you think the word Palestine came from, ladies and gentlemen? From the Romans, because they wanted to embarrass the Jewish people. So they took the arch enemy from the Torah, the Plishtim, the Philistines, and called, they didn't want to call it Eretz Israel anymore. So just to shock the Jews, they called it Palestine. How many people do you think today know this? None of them, of course. You do. But I'm saying the average Joe on the street, they think Palestinians, it doesn't mean anything to them. When you say that's a historical insult to Jewish people, because there was no Palestine, there was an Eretz Israel, King David, King Solomon, etc. So everything we're learning, experiencing today is very real. So what is the takeaway? Takeaway is a couple things. Number one, we have to understand, and I think we do, that we are facing enemies who are not rational. If you want to try to treat them as rational human beings, I don't know about you, but most humans are hardwired with self-preservation mode, right? Yes. And they're not willing to jump into that hot fire if they know it'll be their own demise. It takes a lot to drink that Kool-Aid, you know, to be in Guyana with Jim Jones and to say, I'm drinking the Kool-Aid knowing that this is the last drink I'm ever going to have. That takes a commitment level of a timna that we learned about, or the historic biblical Amalek that attacked us with the Death Star lasers of the cloud destroying us, knowing that he's going to his death. When you strap on, I mean, it's inconceivable to me that you strap on explosives on a human body.
Children.
And you walk into a pizza place like Zabaro's and detonate yourself knowing your body is going to become whatever with nails and things just to add to try to hurt as many people. Like what human being, what rational, thoughtful human being, whatever, even how would you give a person, like what type of coaching would it take, right? To be the Bill Belichick trying to motivate his troops to go do that. No Jew would ever do that. No rational, sane human being would do that. So that's number one. You have to understand that is a Amalek at its essence. It's not the Amalek that we're asking for. Again, this is not to be misquoted. We're not going back to the women, men, children of the war with Saul. We're talking about an identifiable Amalek as someone who hates the Jews. Now, I have to tell you, this is some just observations, okay? If we think, when I say we, I'm talking about America and the rest of the world, the same people. If we think that this stops and begins and ends with the Jews, you're delusional. The same Columbia people took over that building, their placards had death to Israel, and the next placard had death to America. And the people organizing it, who are now being outed, the Rockefellers and George Soros and others, who have been sponsoring these so-called organically grown protests, they're not organically grown. It began in the 60s with radicalization of professors on campus, and it's come, you know, you had the Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter protests. They're experts, okay? Isn't it interesting that the tents in every single tent city in America were all, they're all exactly the same? How is that? I mean, I don't know about you, but if I got a tent, maybe I'll go to Home Depot, maybe I'll go to Lowe's, maybe I'll go to, right? So the placards are all professionally done beautifully. They're there in their hands. And yet, if you see some of the interviews and the people who are just like the unwashed masses coming, you say to them, okay, you're saying from the river to the sea. What river and what sea? I don't know. Do you know what happened on October 7th? No, it's not part of my narrative. Okay. What about Intifada? What does that mean? I don't know. So in other words, 48% of the people who were arrested in New York, the NYPD said this last week, you may have seen this, were literally not connected at all to Columbia or City University of New York. 48% who were arrested. So again, who are these people? They're provocateurs. And again, I hope, I pray, maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm delusional here, because I'm hoping for the best, that many of these young brains of mush are that. They're just ignoramuses, as our friend Bugs Bunny would say. And they're ignorant. They don't know. And there's things going on, and it's the cause of the day. And they're joining their friends, and they don't really understand even what they're doing, what they're protesting, what they really want. I hope, right? There's always a chance, of course, unfortunately, the longer you are occupied by other people's thoughts in your mind, that you can become radicalized yourself. But my prayer is it's not too late. And how do we know how scary that is? So we're going to have the most amazing person on Wednesday night. We already have over 200 people, mostly not from our Jewish community, who are going to come Wednesday to hear this amazing person, Tova Friedman, the youngest survivor Auschwitz-Birkenau. She gave an interview. And in the interview, they asked her specifically, how do you feel? She said, I'm walking out of Auschwitz-Birkenau with my little hand is in my mom's hand. I'm 7 years old. And I said to my mom, I'm free now. I will never have to have anyone ever call me a dirty Jew the rest of my life. She's saying this in context of what's happening in our world today. And then she wanted to say something so powerful, because she's an amazing person. She said, I would tell these people, I would warn them, that when you have such hatred and contempt, it always ends in one place. Someone dies. Whether it's you, the perpetrator who dies, or your people that you're honing in on, everyone dies in the end. It doesn't end in a pleasant way. There's death at the end. So please, for the sake of our country, for your own lives, for our country, please stop. And as we said, it begins, and this is an absolute truth, the people who are the anarchists and for fomenting this rage against Israel, I promise you this, Israel is just the beginning. At the same, you know, in Iran, when they're charging about death to Israel, what's the next sentence out of their mouth? Death to the great Satan. So the big end game is not Israel. That's just the road to get to the big Satan. So let me quote you, because it is Yom HaShoah, from Pastor Martin Niemöller, who was in Dachau death camp. He survived. He was a Lutheran pastor. You know this. First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. That's where we're at right now. And Baruch Hashem, thank God, we have fantastic friends. I had a person come up to me in Wegmans about a week and a half ago. I was a little scared because I wasn't sure about his intent. I was innocently getting some pre-Passover vegetables and fruit, you know, Erev Pesach. And he came over to me and he said, I want to shake your hand. I'm like, whoa. And then I realized, he said, you are God's chosen people. God never forsook you. We love you. We have your back. We are horrified by what's going on. And we will fight shoulder to shoulder to protect you. I have to tell you, I had tears in my eyes.
Yeah.
It was amazing. And we have millions of people, thank God, in America. 80% or more of our God-fearing Americans are with us. Okay, I understand you hear from others who aren't. But we need to focus in. And we also need to understand that as Mrs. Friedman said so profoundly, we could have stopped Hitler in 1938 after Kristallnacht in Germany. We had a window to stop him, and we did not. We did nothing to stop. My prayer, my hope, as Yaakov prayed for the bit to be there, my prayer is that really wonderful people will stand with us the way they are standing with us, and that they understand that this is a solemn day, the Yom HaShoah, for us to remember the 6 million who are not with us. So it should be God's will that in each and every generation he stands with us, and that the rest of our world this time will stand with the Jewish people. So my bracha for you, for all of us, we should be safe. I'll see you Wednesday night to hear from Mrs. Friedman. It's an opportunity, a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity now, to be in the presence of someone so holy, someone who has the ability to give blessings. And I'll leave you with just with this thought, okay? And Mrs. Friedman doesn't want to give you a bracha, only because she said to me on the phone, you know, I feel very ill at ease when people ask me for a blessing. Let me tell you why she should give you a blessing, all of us. And she is a blessing. One of the last Satmar Rebbes, Rabbi Teitelbaum, left Israel for his last journey back to America, never to return to Israel. And his Hasidim, the ones who loved him and followed him, were going to remain behind in Israel. And they were forlorn. They were devastated. And they came to him and they said, Rebbe, they said to the Satmar Rebbe, who do we go to for blessings now that you're not with us? And he said, tomorrow morning, I want you to go to Minyan. I want you to go to your services at the temple, at the synagogue. He says, I want you to look around the synagogue and you'll see an old man or two who are putting their tefillin straps over numbers on their arm, tattooed on their arms. This is such a person who is worthy of giving you God's blessing. So please, God, we will have that blessing Wednesday night together from Mrs. Friedman. And Mirtz Hashem, God will continue to bless the Jewish people. Thank you.